This is Comics Therapy, episode 68. No reviews, just analysis. I'm Aaron Myers, and my better, smarter, cuter co-host is Andrea Shockling.
I can't believe you actually read that.
Well, I didn't read ahead. Up this week, two comics from December 17th, 2014, Wayward number 5 and The Kitchen number 2. In between segments, listen to another Second Opinion, and on the couch, we talked with Ignatz award-winning cartoonist Alec Longstreth. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is Friendship is Magic. We talk a lot about the relationships between characters in comic books, be they superhero teams, mortal enemies, or anything in between. We've discussed the dynamics of romantic relationships, family conflict, and adolescent turmoil. The two comics we're focused on today showcase the strong bonds that form among friends, especially in times of trouble, be it magical or mundane. Either way, though, there's probably a body or two involved, so choose your friends wisely. Make sure at least one of them knows what to do when the shit hits the fan.
Or how to record a podcast.
Yeah, I'm good on that. I follow directions.
Or upload a podcast.
Yeah, well, whatever. I gotta keep you around for something.
Yeah.
Hello, Comics Therapy. My name is Mark Stack. I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener. And I currently write for two websites. I write for Comics Bulletin, where I know several people have already called in with their second opinions. And I also write for EatGeekPlay.com. I've been reading comics since I was a very young kid, but I only regularly started reading them week to week when I was 16 and was able to drive to the local comic book store 8 miles out of town. I love that place. It's called DJ's Comics. It introduced me to a lot of stuff, even though in hindsight it may not have been the best shop. I currently work part-time at another shop here in San Diego where I live now called San Diego Comics. It's a great shop. If you're in the area, you should definitely check it out.
Each episode, in between comic segments, you'll hear one listener answering a series of questions, sharing his or her favorite comics, creators, and more. We call it a second opinion. If you want to play along at home, you can always leave your own response for us to use on a future show. The prompts are on the website, comicstherapy.com, and you can call, Skype, or email your MP3. Remember to read comics responsibly, kids, and always get a second opinion.
Currently my favorite title being published, I would have to say it's Daredevil. The Mark Waid run on Daredevil has so profoundly shaped my life, and it's also the second comic that I actually started reading month to month, and that started with issue 1. And it's the comic that kind of made me realize that I had depression. Yeah, it's not a fun, happy story, but it's a comic that so spoke to me on a level that I didn't understand at the time. And when I finally read issue 10 of the current run, I realized, oh, wow, yeah. This was the book that, like, told me what depression was and how you live with it. So I love that title forever for that.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Aaron Myers and Andrea at Andrea Shock. The show account is at Comics Therapy.
I feel like you've been neglecting the show account. Have you been, I don't know, busy or something recently?
I haven't been neglecting the show account. You've been neglecting the podcast, so I don't have anything to put out.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
Well, sometimes the truth is only met with silence.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
How's your December?
Busy?
Yeah, it has been busy, right?
Yeah, too busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And only getting busier.
Is it going to be a little bit lighter in the new year?
Yeah, I think so. I think after, really after this week, it should be pretty okay.
Pretty okay. Like,
pretty better.
Next week will be chill.
It'll be chiller. Chillish.
Are you gonna get snow? Is it gonna be chilly?
I don't think so. You know, this isn't a weather cast, so it's hard for me to say.
Wow, are we already starting off as enemies, not friends?
Well, you're bringing up as small talk the weather.
It's because I'm leaving for Pittsburgh on Sunday, and possibly I'm a little preoccupied with getting re-acclimated to this bullshit winter stuff.
Well, I'm happy for you. It's just rainy and balmy here. That's the weather report from Eugene.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. See, you are fixated on your health, right? You're always sick, and we always hear about how terrible it is when you're sick. And I am always cold, and therefore when I go to Pittsburgh and I'm colder because it's fucking freezing outside, then you get to hear about that.
Great. Just like a couple of old Jews talking about their ailments and being cold.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
So, yeah, I mean, what's going on? I've been working, like, a lot, and I think you have been too, but nobody wants to hear about that either. So what is going on that is fun and awesome and full of comics win for everyone?
I have lots of comic books that I've been reading and sorting and... Yeah, I mean, what else is there?
I don't know. I'm excited about being kind of on vacation for real so that I can read. I think that that is something that a lot of people look forward to this time of year, is catching up on things that maybe they let slide earlier. Some of us don't get to all of our books every week. Just saying.
Well, I don't understand how that happens.
I guess I just have the wrong priorities.
That is absolutely for sure.
I can't wait to get into this a little bit later when we talk about, like, the perceptions of hierarchy of comic book readers amongst friends. Because, like, I'm going to push this on you. We talked about it, like, off the record earlier, but we're going to get into it as it fits into the theme of the show. When you give me shit friend to friend about how I'm reading my comics, you know, it cuts me to the bone, Aaron Myers.
It's funny because you feel like it's some sort of targeted or discriminatory
yes.
action on my part, except that there's not a person who is exempt or relieved from my ridicule, criticism, and judgment.
That's true. We did. I acknowledge that you are an equal opportunity asshole, so that's fine.
Yeah, so don't put it on me.
Okay, it's cool. You are non-discriminatory. You are just a dick. But
yeah, I don't care if you have a penis or a vagina. I'm still judging you equally in the same way and looking down at you.
Right on. But when we talk about this, like, a little bit further in the context of our books, I'm going to push this a little bit. I'm going to push you a little bit to think about what does it mean to be friends with shared interests?
Okay. Do you want to talk about that now, or are we talking about it now, or are we talking about it later?
I don't know. It's up to you. I mean, I'm kind of planting the seed because, like, we have been talking about this anyway, but we have amongst us, we have neither magic nor mob connections. I'm just making that assumption, by the way. So, Wayward and The Kitchen, two really great books that deal with friendship. But, like, sprinkled in amongst that, I want to get some, like, real talk in there, too. Are you up for that?
Sure. Why don't we just talk about that now, then?
Because I'm not sure that that's going to be enough. Maybe I'm going to keep bringing it up.
Well, fine. But you need to start this out for me.
Okay.
So that means you talk.
Okay,
because I'm not, I am not then starting after telling you to start.
Here's what, just so that everybody is like on the same page. Here is a conversation that Aaron and I had earlier. It's not the first time that he and I have talked about this. It's not the first time that I've talked about it with anybody, but it is sort of something that I have observed primarily with online interactions amongst friends with a shared interest. And so, like, we aren't a bunch of, like, magical adolescents, and we're not a bunch of women in the 70s collecting money for our mobster husbands. But we are, in fact, a really tight community of comics fans who have, like, the same kinds of push and pull and tug and, like, you know, hard love that you get with friends who are, like, joking and kidding around and are often sarcastic by default, right? It's like the banter mentality. And what I have noticed, I think, this is anecdotal, but that there is a difference in the way that men interact with other men about comics compared to women and men about comics. I know, I just blew your mind, right? You've never heard that before. But here's what I'm seeing. There's an assumption, there's a default when guys and girls talk. Again, a lot of this is online. To go the route of like, girls don't read comics. It's so easy to use that as a joke. To just be like, hey, we're friends, so we're going to now joke, but we're going to joke in a way that is going to demean your opinion and actually your relevancy to sit at the table. And that is a thing that happens, like, from men to women, but that I find does not happen from, like, you know, men to men. So that's the entire basis for my thoughts about this. It's not that it, I'm not actually talking about, like, for real harassment. I want to make that incredibly clear that what I am describing and what I am observing is not the, like, really sort of disgusting, problematic, sexist harassment behavior that we've all discussed and that, like, many of us have experienced. What I'm seeing instead is that, like, under the guise of friendship, we rely too much on belittling one another, and that that is exacerbated when you look at it through the lens of sort of traditional gender roles. The end.
Here's a couple of thoughts.
Okay. And then we can talk about comics?
This is about comics in general.
Okay.
I think in terms of men and women in the comics fandom, or I guess in a lot of fandoms that would be a traditionally male fandom, the women are in the position of proving worth, while men are accepted into the club automatically.
Yeah, true.
So even if the banter is the same, the position a woman will take when faced with that same sort of challenging derision that is, I guess, kind of natural in these sort of subcultures, the default defense, you're going to be more apt to bristle.
See, my response to that is that, like, the default is to play the just one of the guys card, not to bristle. Because if you bristle, then you're a bitch. But if you're just one of the guys and you just, like, continue to perpetuate that same sort of behavior, then it's fine, right? Nobody actually knows that it can be a little bit destructive and kind of undermine the very friendships that you're, you know, hoping to encourage. And I think that women in predominantly, like, male-focused fandoms, like comics, or traditionally male-focused, you know, whatever. It's easier to be just one of the guys. It's safer, in fact, because then you are not a threat, and then you are not challenging. And so it's a subservient one of the guys role.
Right, yeah. It's so you've got, yeah, because you have the pecking order.
Yeah. Because you're not actually one of the guys. But
as well, long you're as one of the guys in terms of, like, how there will always be a beta male in a group of male friends right. who is the brunt of the jokes right. and is allowed to be part of the group because the rest of the group can use them as the, you know, the whipping boy.
Right. And so what I've seen is that the like, women who are... I hate to turn this into a matter of hierarchy, but that's how it is perceived by many men. So even women who are legitimate comics fans and have been for years, blah, 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 blah. I think that that use of the word legitimate in that sentence, like speaking of bristling, like that really fucking bothers me. But just for the sake of argument, like you've got women who've got the street cred, and yet that's not enough to escape that default, like, oh, do girls even read comics? Like, it's just a thing that we all say. And I'm saying we, because women do it also. Like, we are very much a part of that perpetuating the just the guys thing amongst friends. And again, I need to emphasize that I'm talking about this as something that I see with people who like one another, with friends. Like, it's it's not like a stranger danger kind of threatening behavior. It's the roles that we place ourselves in. And I'm just like, huh, why is that? And like, why doesn't that bother any of us?
Because it's a human nature issue. I think you're trying to make it a fandom issue, but I think it's just a human interaction issue.
So, by nature, women place themselves in, like, a safer, subservient role so as not to, like, challenge men. Is that what you're saying?
No, by nature, humans will establish a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And by design, people entering a group of established that has an established power order to it mm-hmm. will enter in at the lower rung.
Okay, but just to make this be about comics, how the fuck do you decide who has the power when you're just talking about a bunch of people reading a pile of books every week?
But it's not. You're equating comics fandom to people reading comics.
What would you say that is?
It's a group of people who have entered that room with the key of, I read comic books. Can I be part of this club? Once you enter the door, sure, you're part of the club. The club, in so many ways, has nothing to do with comics other than the comics being the gauge to which your establishment in the power order is, you know, is defined.
So it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you're a man or a woman?
And it does, in that women in this fandom start out at a lower power class than men.
Okay. And just come with me on this journey. I don't disagree with what you're saying.
Okay.
In fact, I would say that we encourage that. And we're, like, nice about it, right? Again, I'm talking about a group of friends. I'm talking about a community. I'm not talking about the assholes who are out there saying, like, women reading comics is ruining comics for everybody. Like, that's not what this is about. I'm talking about, like, the response to, oh, I haven't read that yet. Well, girls don't even read comics, is just the joke that we use.
Yeah, and there's not a male. That's just not clever. I gotta say, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
I think I see that joke to people. See, it's hard for me to gauge because
you're an equal opportunity asshole.
No, I have a group of friends that I talk with. And it's not a general forum that I'm in some sort of, like, Reddit chat room or IRC chat room, you know? It's different. So I think it's a tired joke, and the only reason, like, I can only go from my perspective.
That's what
so
I'm
it's a little hard for me. Yeah, but my perspective is this. Like, I feel that there's a perception that I read, like, everything, you know?
Sure.
And so if I don't, people will chastise me for, well, you should be reading this. And, you know, maybe I just don't have time to read that. Maybe I'm just not interested in reading that. There's a lot of it. But at the same time, it's fun to throw it back to people almost in mocking the way I'm treated of, oh my God, why aren't you reading that?
Hmm. Okay.
Because it's ridiculous with comic books or science fiction novels or movies to expect everyone to consume everything.
I understand that. And I certainly think that realistically, that's not what anybody is actually expecting. I think
but when though, it, no, but when it comes to the term of saying, oh, well, women don't read comics, it's a challenge. It's a gendered challenge to you to prove your worth in being part of the group.
Absolutely. So by its very nature, it only is something that is thrown out towards women.
Sure, but I wouldn't say it's an endemic within the subculture.
Do you think it's remotely possible that you and I are going to have a different perspective on this particular issue?
I can't imagine how.
Right. I do think that this is something that is very much fueled by the online, like, banter culture in general. The one-upsmanship of, like, who can be pithier and more clever and, you know, more sardonic. And there's a battle of wits that's kind of constantly up and running on, like, Twitter, for example. Much of which is absolutely hilarious and, like, super delightful to follow along. When it is, I think your point about calling it a tired joke, I'm just going to expand on that, and then we're really actually going to talk about comics. It's such a tired joke that it makes me wonder if at the core it's not a joke anymore. Because well, it really I get to talk about this because sure. I'm the girl.
Right.
But it does really make me start to wonder if there's a kernel of belief there that there is a bullshit hierarchy and that women who are reading comics, our opinions are not as useful. Right? You have one guy and one girl and we're both reading the same book. Do we both get to sit at the table and share what we think? And too often, I see the female opinion discounted or secondary. And again, I see that with our friends. I don't see that, or I guess I see it, but I'm not speaking about it on like a large scale community level. That's a whole separate conversation. I think that this topic of friendship, which comes from like a shared experience or like a shared, you know, set of goals and a shared love, it, like sometimes that's not enough. Like sometimes actually friendship isn't magical because it doesn't solve all the problems and people can still be like you. They can still be assholes. Hmm. And it can be a joke that goes too far. So that it's not a joke anymore.
Well, sure. But then it's the onus is upon the attacked person to not call out their attacker.
Wait. The onus is on the attacked person. In my hypothesis, right? We're talking mm-hmm. about the women. Yep. The onus is on the women to be like, hey, please don't do that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Dude, no. No, the onus is on all of us to not be dicks.
Obviously, yes, but you have someone who is being a dick to you, whether they know it or not. If you call them out and explain how it is hurtful and less and makes them the lesser.
Oh God, no, no.
And they continue to do it, then they're not your friend. If you call them out and they go, oh shit, okay, yeah, sorry, you know, I didn't really think of it that way. I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay. I'm not interested in enforcing any kind of, like, comics internet police state here where everybody has to only be nice to each other all the time. I'm certainly not interested in shutting down sarcastic banter, because I get off on that too. I'm just saying that that cannot be well, the only thing. It can't.
But you can't have it both. You can't have it both ways.
Why
you
not?
Can't say. You
Why
can't say.
You be both funny and kind?
You can, but
can you?
People, but assholes will continue to be assholes if they get positive, if they get positive reinforcement from their asshole behavior. So if you as a subservient female encourage a male to continue asshole behavior, then it's partly your fault.
Oh God, we have to start talking about the actual books before I climb through the computer and punch you in the face.
No, it's because it's ridiculous to assume somebody's going to change without any sort of action.
Is it that ridiculous to expect that there would be a more, like, reasonable acceptance of how to treat, like, human to human?
But how does that change?
What do you mean? How does that change? I'm saying that right now things are a little bit off, and it's skewed heavily in the direction of, like, let's point at the girls and make fun of them because it's easy, and, like, maybe
okay.
That shouldn't be the thing.
I agree. Who points that out? Because the people doing it aren't going to point to themselves.
Right, so I hate everything.
No, hang on. Because I don't want this to be construed as I'm blaming the victim. And I'm saying, well, because it's easy to take it that way. Like, hey, maybe you shouldn't have been wearing that in that chat room.
It's easy to take it that way. It's also really easy to extrapolate out with the way that you're saying, you know, the women need to stand up and say, that joke isn't funny, blah, blah, blah. And then pin that same mentality onto some of the larger conversations about, like, harassment and, you know, sexism and abuse and so on and so forth. I mean, inherently, we are talking about a form of sexism. It's just that it's hidden under the, like, very careful rose-colored glasses of friendship. See what I did there? Can we talk about the books now? Because
because I want a chance to clarify myself.
Go.
I'm not saying it's only the job of women to point out to men when they're being sexist and marginalizing them.
Okay.
I think it's everyone's responsibility.
Right on.
I think it's helpful if you feel marginalized and that you have sexist comments coming your way from someone you consider to be a friend, to let that friend know.
This is turning into it makes it sound like we're talking about one specific person, and I'm not at all, because, like,
maybe
I'd
that person that you do a
say,
maybe when that person you do a podcast with, you say you let them, you call them up and you say, hey, stop being a dick. Maybe hypothetically that's just what you do.
That could be a thing that you do. No, this is a trend. It's not just me. It's not just, you know, one or two or five other people. It is something that I have seen, and it's, like, not even an isolated series of incidents. It's, like, over the past couple of years.
Change comes from the community.
Yeah.
But the only way it comes is if the community starts to police itself, and the only way that comes is by pointing out.
It's hard to police something. God, I hate that word right now. It's hard to say, like, this is a problem when it's not malicious. Okay? It's being one of the guys is not an inherently bad thing. It's actually very flattering in terms of acceptance. It's just that I'm not one of the guys.
Okay. See, that's,
so maybe I do want it both ways. Like,
you
I
do,
want,
because it becomes very difficult then for someone who may not be aware, or, you know, I don't know if you know this, but part of the comics culture is it tends to attract sometimes a certain type of personality that might not have the best social awareness or social skills.
Oh, I feel like I met that guy more than once.
Yeah. So it's beneficial then sometimes to help them understand social interaction, whether it be online or in person.
Fine. All of this is good. All of this
Is this about me now?
It's not. It was never about you. But it also was never really exclusively about me. Although, God, it sounds like it is.
All I know is now I'm terribly uncomfortable and I don't want to speak to you ever again.
Awesome. Is this where I get bristly and defensive?
Yep. Let's talk about some comics.
Cool.
And my second favorite comic being published right now, I would have to say, is Grayson. I can't say enough good things about this book. I really didn't expect a lot from it going into it. But Tom King and Tim Seeley, the co-writers on that book, and Michael Janin, the artist, just fantastic work they're doing. They're creating a work that it's really a whole lot of fun, and it's something that I wish I could see more of these days in comics. And it definitely does share some DNA with Daredevil. Not so much on the thematic level, but on the sense of fun that accompanies each issue.
Our first book this week is Wayward Number 5, written by Jim Zub, with line art by Steve Cummings. Colors are by Tamara Bonvillain, and lettering is by Marshall Dillon. Wayward is published by Image Comics.
I just realized that I didn't write summaries for either of the books this week.
Not surprised.
Sorry. But, Wayward... Wayward is the story of a young woman who has recently moved to Japan to live with her mother, who is Japanese, after previously living with her father, who is Irish. And upon arriving in Japan, she seems to have taken on some unusual abilities. She's not the one who uses words like magic and spells. You know, at least not at first. But that's clearly the direction that we are heading in. And she has, with these new powers, with these new abilities, she's attracted a group of similarly powered, unique teenage individuals. And they're, you know, gonna band together and fight against the bad stuff, right? It's not quite a standard superhero origin story setup. There's a lot of stuff going on here with identity and, you know, fish out of water kind of challenges. But at the core, we do have a group of friends who have this like shared experience of being unique. And in some ways being sort of outcasts because of that. And that's really what Wayward is exploring.
Yeah, this book's all about two worlds.
Yeah, yeah, in a way that I find, you know, really, really appealing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's surprising how it's evolved over these last, you know, few issues. But it starts out as like a fish out of water, you know, thrown into a culture that you're only kind of half part of. But mm-hmm. it's really that on like four different levels.
So I think that Romy is very like prepared for this move. Like she knows the language. She's been immersed in the culture by her mother growing up. But she still has never actually been to Japan. And so that initial setup of like, now you're here and everything is different and crazy and also you have no friends is very jarring. It's a very like intentionally isolating experience. And I think therefore the attachment that she has to the rest of her group kind of quickly makes a lot of sense. If she was already in a place where she was comfortable, the notion of like, boom, instant friends and instant trust that goes along with friendship that like more traditionally would take like time to build is like appropriately rushed because of the other circumstances.
Yeah. And sort of desperation to cling to anything that, you know, that can give you anchors in a new world, too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I don't know that if, you know, she had grown up in, it doesn't say, but, like, if she'd grown up in Dublin, and suddenly she has these powers that manifest in Dublin, and she has this support group of friends and family, that's a different story, and that's perhaps a different exploration of, you know, old and new friends. But I think that one of the reasons why, even in the face of some of the, like, tragedy that they very quickly and intensely experienced, and I'm not even talking about what happens in this issue specifically, mm-hmm. but even leading up to it, there is, like, a, like, an inherent bond that is positive as opposed to negative. Like, she's not freaking out and saying, oh my God, get away from me, I don't ever want to see you guys again, this is totally fucked up. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite. It's like, let's meet up. Hey, let's come up with a name. And, you know, there's a desire to continue the relationship. Like, even though they skipped a couple of steps of, you know, building trust and understanding and you know, group dynamic, blah, blah, blah.
Sure. Maybe that's for urgency of storytelling and urgency of survival.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Yeah, but plus,
there's a whole bunch of cats, and, like, cats are great.
Sure, cats are fine. It's hard to... Yeah, it's hard now to talk too much more about this book because we're at this kind of cusp, you know? Mm-hmm. There was something major that happened that breaks that friendship dynamic. And it's really that test at this point of friendship out of necessity versus friendship out of caring, I guess, you know?
Oh, okay. Oh, man. Really? You think that some of this is friendship out of necessity? That's, like, heartbreaking.
I think all of her friends right now are friendship out of necessity.
I was giving them more credit than that. I was saying it was trust out of necessity, but that the bond of friendship kind of was the, like, the bonus gift. Or maybe the other way around. Maybe you're right. Maybe the... I guess, to me, it felt a little bit more authentic.
Yeah, I think they have been thrown together by circumstance. And friendship comes from something more, something that longer.
So in your experience, does that translate to any kind of longevity of friendship?
Circumstance?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I'm thinking about moments in my life where people were thrown together and it was, like, intense and, and, you know, it wasn't magical awakening, blah, blah, blah. But, like, even going to, like, an intensive conference, like, professional conference, or... Mm-hmm. Hell, even freshman year of, like, undergrad in college, or, you know, whatever. You're kind of a victim of circumstance. So your friendship, it's a product of, like, that moment in time. Does it translate? Like, for Romy, does it?
Well, you're talking about something that's a moment in time. The sustainability, though, still, I still think, kind of hinges on some sort of proximity or contact. So. Yeah. So, you know, you could go to a conference or have, like, 2 weeks. Like, I think of, like, I did that Birthright Israel trip. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was 2 weeks with people, and you're thrown together with people you've never met before, and you are together 24 hours a day for, you know, almost 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for 6 months to a year afterwards, people are keeping in touch, you know, you're writing emails, that sort of stuff. And they're still, you know, they're all over the country and Canada and everywhere else. It's, you lose contact.
But you and so, went so on the friendships that trip before social media, yeah?
Right. So social media now provides a way of kind of sustaining that interpersonal connection that can sustain longevity to those sort of initially quickly formed friendships.
Except when people are assholes.
That sucks. No. Some people are assholes, but they're beloved as well.
Oh, fair enough.
Uh-huh. Lovable
so
assholes.
So what if it's an intense experience that is, like, inherently negative? Like, the thing that brought you together, your shared experience is one of trauma. And therefore, your bond is really strong because you went through it together. But, like, you know, that's it.
I there's no black and white with that. It is, it's still a matter of circumstance and details and everything else that comes afterwards.
Okay.
Because a person, say you have a traumatic death that brings two people together, it also might want drive them apart because the reminder of that trauma mm-hmm. with the other person is more than you want to, you know, maintain.
Right.
So who's to say?
Do you think the fact that the characters in Wayward are adolescents? They're teenagers. They're like a little bit more pliable as people, and therefore their relationships are.
Their relationships are, and there's still so much of their life to, you know, to go forward with that as they become adults, who they gel and become fully changes.
Are you close friends with anybody that you were friends with when you were a teenager?
Yeah, just a handful, though.
Like, actual close friends? Like,
let's
qualify this. You stay in touch, like you said, and there is an intent to generate proximity, you know, more than once every decade.
Maybe with a couple of people, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not a great example for that.
No, I was just curious.
Yeah.
Well, you're not a great example for much in terms of social interaction, but mm-hmm. I was just curious with this one.
No, that's fine. Even this is really starting to weigh on me, so maybe it's time to move on to our second book.
It's going to be like this from here on out.
Well, 20 more minutes or so.
Now, my past series recommendation is going to be the other book that I started reading around the same time as Daredevil. That's Rick Remender's run on Venom. It is one of the darkest, most humorous, and strangest books that I can recall reading at the time. And it does this great thing where when it makes Flash Thompson into Venom, it takes his nearly 50 years of history at that time and turns into an origin story for this new kind of hero, who ultimately isn't that heroic, and sees his dreams of being a hero sort of crushed along the way. It's a really dark book, but it reaches a fantastic ending, which you can choose to continue on with Cullen Bunn run, or you can just simply stop there. It's really up to the readers to decide, but it has some standout work by artists like Tony Moore and Declan Shalvey.
Our second book this week is The Kitchen No. 2, written by Ollie Masters and drawn by Ming Doyle. Colors are by Jordi Belair, and letters are by Clem Robbins. The Kitchen is an 8-part miniseries published by Vertigo.
And as I inferred earlier, we are, in fact, dealing with women in the 70s whose husbands have been put away for criminal behavior. They were all part of the mob. And so these three ladies, I believe it is two sisters and then a friend, officially. But please, Aaron, correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that's correct.
and sort of what they do when the men are not available, both professionally, if we can use that term for the kinds of stuff that they do,
mm-hmm.
You know, financially, but also as a support system. It is, I think, pretty clear that the closeness of their friendship is a little, I don't know, more of a, they're not as close as they could be. They don't talk as much as they could. They don't share as much or as deeply as they could. And I guess I'm pointing that mostly to, like, the fact that it's kind of an accident that they discover amongst themselves that, like, they could be taking up the reins from their husbands. Like, they could be doing more of the jobs. Like, they hadn't all gotten together and sort of decided that proactively.
Sure.
One of them was, and then stumbled on it with the other two. So what we have then is a chance for their friendship to be both a matter of circumstance and be reinforced by proximity, but then also you know, really be like an important support system for these three women because of the circumstances.
Well, it's another one of those friendship by necessity, by survival.
Sure, by survival.
Yeah, especially after we've only read two issues so far, but we definitely know it's a we're in this together situation.
And we're all in it 100%, which is like the way that it was described in this issue especially, is that it had been asymmetrical previously.
Right, right.
And now it's not. And what is a stronger demonstration of friendship than, like, you know, beating somebody else to a pulp?
Sure. You know, I would consider this not friendship, though, because it's almost like a business relationship.
Between the women?
Yes.
Tell me why that is, because I think that that's interesting that you have that point of view.
Because there's nothing to indicate that they necessarily care about each other. They care about themselves. They're desperate, in a desperate situation for survival. And only through them sticking together will they, you know, find the tenacity and the power to overcome the adversity.
So what I said earlier about it being about, oh gosh, Andrea, you were so clever 40 minutes ago, that you need to have the kindness there as well. Is that what you're saying, that you haven't yet seen a demonstration of some of the more touchy-feely aspects of friendship?
Sure, yes. You know, I kind of equate it to, like, the Avengers.
Okay.
I would say most of the time the Avengers are not friends.
Okay.
Because they are superheroes with superpowers who are faced with adversity, and their power sets come together. And because they're quote-unquote good, they will overcome that. But there's plenty of times where they're fighting and beating the crap out of each other for whatever one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get the feeling most of the time that most of them like each other. I mean, ultimately, friendship is about liking the other person.
Right, which is why when you have a problem amongst friends, fixing it should be, like, mutually beneficial. It should be something that, like,
no. Friendship
all parties are invested in.
No, wrong. Friendship should be without. It should be selfless. If friendship is somebody needs something from you, you giving of yourself without expectation of reciprocity.
How is that different from what I just said?
You said it should be mutually beneficial.
Right. So it shouldn't be that. I'm coming to you because I have a problem and you are just like, fine, whatever the fuck, I'm sorry. It should be like, oh, wow, I didn't realize. And so let us like fix that and move forward together because we're both getting something out of this relationship.
No, I think you're adding something into there that doesn't exist. So I have a problem. You're my friend. I come to you in terms of aid.
No, what if the problem is, like, with you? Right? I'm just going back to the, like, if it's an interpersonal problem, then an actual friend is going to be like, yeah, it's of my benefit as well as yours for us to resolve this problem that we have, you know, with one another.
Sure, to maintain the friendship, yes.
Yeah. I understand what you mean if there's, like, an external problem, and I come to you, and I'm like, dude, I need help. Then right. You can be selfless and be like, fuck yeah, I'm your friend. I got you.
Right. You know, I call you up, and I say, dude, I messed up.
Right.
I need you to help me bury this body out in the woods.
Yeah. Don't do that. I don't.
And the cell phone logs don't necessarily
line up.
You know, line up, but
if you are calling me from a Best Buy, I am not going to answer.
Okay.
Actually, don't fucking call me. Text me.
Right. Right.
God,
right.
Who calls?
Well, it was the 90s. So,
but I think that I agree with you that, and I think that's what I was saying a bit before, that we haven't seen evidence of the, like, tightness of like female friendships are not portrayed very frequently. They just aren't. And so it would be lovely if, in addition to watching them develop as mobsters and kicking ass and taking names, like, they also really had the chance to have, like, this more kind of organic, trust-based friendship that is something other than just, like, a victim of circumstance.
Well, I guess we'll see.
True.
True, we will. But speaking of victims of circumstance, we can talk to our unfortunate interview.
It's not unfortunate at all. You always spin these as negative, probably because we always have grumpy McGrumperson conversations about comics. But in actuality, this was a great conversation with Alec. Talked a lot about some of his excellent books and experiences. And stop making it into something that it's not, dude.
Life is beautiful. Let's talk to Alec.
Plus, there's like the whole point where he said that, you know, I was awesome and I said, yeah, I'm awesome. And you were just like, yeah, whatever. It was a true friendship right there. It was like, that's what it was.
Good. I'm glad you have one friend.
Yeah. Alec and I were friends.
Good.
Who are you again?
Doesn't matter.
Are you actually grumpy?
Not at all.
Let's talk to Alec and we'll catch the rest of you guys next week or so.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people that write about comics online, I am sort of working on my own comics. I'm a writer, so I'm currently working with an artist, a good friend of mine, to produce an 8-page comic that I don't know what we're going to do with it, but we just both want to have work done, work to show people. So I figure once that's done, I'll probably end up being a real jerk to my friends and making them read it. And thank you, Comics Therapy. This has been my second opinion.
This week on The Couch, we welcome Ignatz Award-winning cartoonist and illustrator Alec Longstreth. You may know him from his mini-comic Phase 7 or his gorgeous graphic novel Basewood, published in hardcover this year by Ad House Books. Or maybe you're wearing the sweet t-shirt he designed for the band Weezer. His comics work has appeared in anthologies published by Villard, Three Rivers Press, Dark Horse Comics, Tugboat Press, and many other indie self-publishers. He was a fellow at the Center for Cartoon Studies, and he teaches for CCS and the California College for the Arts for their MFA Comics program. Thank you for talking with us today, Alec.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be on the podcast.
Oh, well, we're honored to have you.
Yeah. All right, honors all around.
make sure the medals get pinned and the sashes get worn.
Yeah.
Can I
make one slight adjustment to that intro?
Oh, hell yeah.
So the only thing that was awesome, thank you for putting that all together. The only thing is that I published Basewood by myself through a Kickstarter. So that's a Phase 7 comics release. Chris Pitzer at Ad House helped me distribute it, which is awesome. But
okay, so I thought that was what you did. You know, because that's sort of exactly what you are known for. The reason I got tripped up a little bit with the way that the book is listed elsewhere, like not on your site.
Yeah, on Amazon, for instance, they say Ad House, and I like even emailed them, and I was like, hey, actually, you know, like, I know if you look it up through your distribution channel, that's what it says, but I did it myself. And then they're like, no, prove it. And I'm like, well, it says it on the book. Or like, I don't know, I've got 2,000 books in my storage unit. You want me to send you a picture?
Right,
but for whatever official Amazon reasons, they couldn't do that. But
then
so I just wanted to make that clear. It's a self-published book.
Very clear. We're going to talk about it more in a little bit, and we're going to talk about what self-published means, like, cool, specifically for you. But thank you for clarifying that, because it's a really important distinction. So right on.
Well, in addition to that, let's do a quick overview of current projects. So you had Basewood out in hardcover. Phase 7 number 20, which is a companion to Basewood. And we're going to go deeper into those. Maybe you can lay out some specifics for us about what you're up to in 2015, things we can look forward to now that we've caught up with all your other back catalog.
Yeah, so the other project I just finished is like a trilogy about Weezer, which Andrea mentioned, which is my favorite band, my all-time favorite band. The fact that I did a t-shirt for them like makes my brain melt. all my dreams are coming true right now.
Awesome.
So when I finished Basewood, it was a really long slog. It took me about 7 years to draw that book. And so I just wanted to have more fun making comics. So the Weezer fan trilogy was sort of a way to loosen up, have some fun, tell some funny stories. And so I finished that up this year as well. So I'm sort of preparing to launch into the next. I have like a nerd trilogy. The three loves of my life are Star Wars, Weezer, and comics, of course. So a while ago, I drew a Phase 7 arc about my love for comics and how I got into comics called Transition, which was issues number 10 and 11. Mm-hmm. I just finished the Weezer trilogy, and then I'm preparing to tell the Star Wars arc of my autobio comics. So that's a very long story sort of about my lifelong love for Star Wars. And I actually went to Australia in 2003 to try and work on the third one, which I can't, Revenge of the Sith. I went all the way to Australia. I like showed up and knocked on the gate and was like, hi, I'm here to help you build the sets or whatever.
Oh, really?
They were awesome. Like, who are you, mate? Or whatever. And then, of course, I did not get that job. But it's an interesting story. So I'm sort of preparing that. I'm writing that. I'm not sure that'll happen within the 2015 calendar year, but coming soon to a website near you, that'll be
available. And it'll probably be continuing, too, because now we have new movies. So, you know, the saga continues.
That's right. Yeah, it really is a lifelong thing. So. Awesome. Yeah, so that, and then I'm also getting ready to launch a web comic called Isle of Elsie. And so that'll probably start maybe late in 2015 or early in 2016. But I've been talking to a lot of people that do web comics, and it seems really important to build up a big buffer of pages so that I'm not like sweating weekly deadlines. So I'll be working on that all year, but people might not see that until a little bit later. So that's kind of what's on my plate right now in the comic sense.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? I hear Isle, I think of a fantasy story. It sounds like it's more in line with like Basewood type storytelling as opposed to your autobio stuff. Is that a total misconception on my part?
No, you hit the nail right on the head. You got
awesome.
It. Awesome. One word, Isle. Wow, cool.
Right?
yes, it's an all ages fantasy comic. And Basewood, I think I've heard from a lot of people that they've read Basewood with their kids. Like you guys have kids, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
My son is 9 and he read Basewood.
Okay.
And yeah, my kids are much younger, so.
Much younger. Okay. Yeah. Cause I've had people read it with their kids as young as like 6 and they say that they enjoy it. Seems a lot that there's a couple sort of scary parts with the monster that might be, that might be a little young, but yeah, like 9 and up, people have really enjoyed Basewood. Isle of Elsie is probably even a little bit younger, like trying to put jokes in and make it funny and a little bit more goofy and stuff. So yeah. All ages, that's the term, right? It's for kids.
Yeah,
I want to put for kids, but then I'm scared that like adult readers will get freaked out and go, oh, well, if it's for kids, I can't read it because I'm not a kid. So,
but there's a difference. I think that we all define it like on our own terms, but I do, and we hate it. We hate the distinction and the semantic argument, but it's still important. But I do think that like all ages is what I would describe Basewood as all ages for my family personally, just because it's missing the things that would designate it as exclusively for adults. Like there's no sexual content. There's no, the language is totally appropriate. And that is primarily what I'm looking for. And then we're looking to avoid in the case of like handing it to my kid. But then there's like the nuances of sophistication of story. And that's where I think all ages is fine because it can exist on multiple levels. Like it can resonate differently with adults and kids, just like the go-to example that a lot of people use is like a Pixar film. Mm-hmm. It's all ages because it appeals to like literally all ages, right? But it can appeal in different ways to those various ages. So I'm like... totally comfortable saying Basewood is all ages.
Cool. Yeah, I'm glad. And I mean, that's what I would hope is that anyone could read it. And for Isle of Elsie, I've been really kind of struggling with this because part of me, I feel like we've gone so far, you know, like I feel like comics as a community kind of had a chip on its shoulder a couple years ago where it's like comics aren't for kids anymore or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we've gone so far in that direction that comics aren't for kids anymore.
Right.
So like part of me wanted, like when I was sort of brainstorming Isle of Elsie and stuff, I wanted to put like for kids right across the top, super big with an exclamation point. That's like, you know, this is for kids. I want kids to read it. That's what I'm excited about. But then the more that I sort of look around, it seems like all ages is kind of a term that hopefully encompasses that, or like that's like secret code to parents. They look at that and they see for kids.
Even just when I'm buying comics at the comic shop and the occasional parent might walk in, what the terminology they'll say is, you know, where are your all ages comics?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so I think it's been adopted in kind of the mainstream as the term, like, where are the comics I can give to my kids without having to worry about it?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to go for all ages, but it's for kids.
It's for everyone. Well,
it's for everyone. There you go.
So speaking of this year, you were like literally all over the map in 2014.
Yes.
And I know that that was really rough for you, like travel wise and time wise. And you've stated that you're not doing any shows at all next year to sort of recover from this year.
Yeah.
But hold on. Cause I'm going to push back a little bit on that.
Okay,
cause you're an independent creator. You self-publish your stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it's safe to say that this year was like your biggest year. So are you concerned at all about the lack of face time with potential readers, or is ultimately that worth it because the work-life balance is very important and you are self-publishing, like you are in charge of your own destiny?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. Yeah, we're recording this, for anyone that doesn't know, like in the waning moments of 2014, sort of mid-December.
Right.
Yeah, and I did 12 shows this year, which I know some people probably roll their eyes like. I think John Porcellino just got back from tour from doing King Cat Comics and Stories, and he just did like 30 dates in 45 days something, and he drove all over the country. I mean, my jaw is on the floor when I read stuff like that, because I did like 12 shows this year, and for me that was just way too much. I'm totally burned out, and it's been kind of a drag just being at shows where normally I'm very excited and I get to share my work with people and see my colleagues and stuff, but this year by the end of it, I was just totally burned out. But yeah, it is. It's kind of an experiment, to answer your question, Andrea. I don't really know. It might be a totally bad idea to disappear for a year from the con circuit. But I'm hoping that I'll be able to come back a year from now in 2016. I'll have started Isle of Elsie. I'll have a couple new issues of Phase 7. You know, I'd like to have a bunch of new stuff so that people are like, oh, I haven't seen you in a while. I'll be like, look, I've been busy.
Right.
But yeah, and then also just the fact, like, I tallied it up, and it was like 60 days that I was on the road. So like literally 2 months of this year, I was just on the road.
And is that sort of, when you look at that from a productivity standpoint too, is that like you have to factor in getting your work out in front of people at conventions versus being able to actually produce work during that time?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, I want to spend, you know, I almost want to just like hit a stopwatch on January 1st and be like, let's see how much work I can get done, you know, in January and February, and be like, this is the time, you know, that I wasn't on the road. Mm-hmm. I was able to do this much work. But yeah, I mean, that's, you guys are totally in tune with that. It's just like, I need some of that time to get some of these projects started. Or like I said, you know, those 2 months that I'll get back will probably buy me enough time to build up the Isle of Elsie buffer so that I can start that comic and then get out and start promoting it, but have that kind of cushion without having to, like, you know, be on the floor at SBX or something and then like run up to my hotel room to draw my page that's due the next day or whatever. I don't want to be in that mindset.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want our listeners to know that Basewood was initially written and released in installments through Phase 7 several years ago. But now they can purchase the hardcover. They can get it from you. They can get it from their local comic shop if they order through Diamond, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Lulu, I think, also is distributing it.
Is that right? I'm not sure.
Amazon?
It's in Amazon, and Lulu's owned by Amazon, so they might have pushed it out there because they sort of push out to their different channels. But it's definitely available through Amazon.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that. Kind of revisiting a work and reconceiving it for publication in a different format. Was that always the dream for Basewood? Because it's quite different than your other more autobiographical storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I always conceive Basewood as a graphic novel,
Okay.
you know, as a as it's going to be under one spine, and I want it to be really nice and big. Yeah, and I finished drawing Basewood in 2011. So you know, and I shopped it around. I tried to find a publisher for it. I had some interest from various people, and then you know, it takes 4 months or something for like a publisher to actually get through that, show it to all their different editors, talk about it, and get back to you. At least that was my experience. And so after doing that for like a year, and then my wife was diagnosed with papillary thyroid cancer, which was a
Oh,
bummer.
wow. Oh,
And
man.
so I was sort of like, oh, I'm ready to, you know, it's 2012 and I've decided that I'm going to self-publish it because these publishers don't want to do it. Let's do this. And then I was like, whoa, my wife has cancer. Or she was my girlfriend at the time. We got married. And then my wife was having cancer treatment and they sliced her open and took the cancer out and all this stuff. And so that was just kind of like one of those curveballs that life throws at you. So, you know, I had to get to work. I had to make some money to cover all of her medical expenses and all that kind of stuff. So that took up almost a year. Like just I took on some like big illustration projects that I normally wouldn't do because it just ate up all of my time. I did a book for James Patterson for the middle school series and it was like I can't even remember 200 illustrations in 4 months or something. I mean, it was just bonkers. But you know, that allowed us to kind of like make sure that my wife Claire was okay. And then once like the dust settled from that, then I was like, okay, so let's get back to Basewood. And then, you know, I did a Kickstarter and sort of like went through the process. So just the way it kind of worked out, it was almost a year ago exactly in January of 2014. I like was holding the book in my hands and it was done. So it's a little strange, but yeah, because like Phase 7 subscribers or people who have seen me at shows have seen it in mini comic form. It was Phase 7, number 5 through 9. And it was like, oh, I've kind of seen this. But yeah, I made sure the production was really nice. I tried to make it a beautiful book. It's oversized, it's hardback, it's got a debossed title, you know, it's got a textured cover stock. I went through and redrew a bunch of stuff in chapter one so that the art's consistent throughout. And you know, one of the great benefits, I think, at least of self-publishing is I don't have a big army of editors and production people that need to get paid. I just did it all myself. So, you know, it's $20 for a 216-page 9x12 hardcover book. I think that's sort of pretty reasonably priced. So it's been fun getting it in front of people and finally putting it out as like the finished version. I never have to touch Basewood again. That book is exactly what I've always dreamed it would be. So that feels good.
Well, how was that Kickstarter experience?
It was kind of crazy. I was really worried. I asked for $10,000, which was going to sort of cover just the printing. And I made that in less than 48 hours. I put it up and it just kind of happened, which was amazing. You know, it's weird. Have you guys ever done a Kickstarter, either of you?
No.
We haven't, you know, obviously been on the back end of it. I think Aaron and I are both like very passionate supporters of various Kickstarter projects, and have good friends who have gone through the process and so have heard some great stories like yours and some horror stories.
Yeah, and it's just been interesting because, like, I'm the same way. I had backed a lot of things, but I had never done it myself. But as soon as you cross that line, you know, I just get emails still to this day. It was like a year ago. I still get emails like, oh, well, how did yours, you know, what was the secret? How did you get yours to fund in 48 hours? And I think really what it was is like, I've been self-publishing since 2002. So, you know, 12 years of self-publishing or 11 years of self-publishing is probably the key because I've just made a lot of connections. People know I've been working on the book. I've been passing out the mini comic version and stuff like that. So when it came around, I think half of the funding was people I knew, you know, that were Phase 7 fans or Phase 7 subscribers. And they said, well, sure, I want a nice book version of this. And then I was lucky enough, it was kind of slow that week, or I don't know what was going on Kickstarter, but because it was going up so fast, it got featured on the like what's hot thing on the front of Kickstarter. And so the other half of the backers are just like random people. Like I have never met them. They just saw it on Kickstarter. And then it was like featured in the Andrea and I are both out in the Bay Area, so it was in like the Bay Area local, you know, Kickstarter projects.
Awesome.
And then it was like also in the comics one or something. So, and their analytics are amazing on the back end of Kickstarter once you are creating a project. So it tells you where like each person came from and how they got to the website and backed it. So it's really interesting to sort of break it down like that. But yeah, about half the traffic was just through random people who were on the Kickstarter website. They saw it and backed it.
Did you do any incentives or I guess specific like Kickstarter targeting for retailers with Basewood?
Yeah, I did a 5-pack. So it was like if you own a store, you know, I think they were wholesale price, so it was like $50. It was like get 5 copies of the book and then go ahead and resell them or whatever.
Awesome.
So yeah, I got some people on that. And I tried to keep my system really simple. I think I had 7 tiers. I know some people have 500 tiers and they commit to all this stuff. I tried to keep it really simple, and I'm proud that most of my funding came from just people kind of like pre-ordering the book.
Right.
So that was a nice way. And I ended up doubling the goal. I made $20,000. And so I used the extra money to pay for all the, you know, shipping and stuff like that. And then I as Aaron mentioned, I made Phase 7 number 20, which is sort of a companion volume, and it's got the making of Basewood. And then I have this really talented composer friend, Andy Hentz. And so he made a rock opera version of Basewood called Songs from the Basewood. So that comes as like a CD, and we produce that whole album. So I probably went another $10,000 into debt just like doing all that stuff. But I don't know. All that stuff it's sort of weird. I've seen some blog posts where people are like, here's how much money I went into debt to do my, you know, comic book on Kickstarter. But at the end of the day, I got the book for free, right? Like I didn't have to pay for it. So 500 copies went out the door to the Kickstarter backers, but then the other 1500 copies, as I sell those through Diamond and at shows and whatever, that's pure profit because I didn't have to pay for those.
Right.
So I've made back that money. You know, I didn't, you know, go bankrupt from it or anything. So I think you just got to kind of think of it holistically and all the different ways that money is involved there.
I think that a lot of the horror stories that I've heard come from those 500 tiers of incentives. Like once you hit your goal, when you start adding stretch goals and a whole bunch of new incentives that then you also have to pay for.
Yeah.
Like as the creator, you're promising things that then you also have to produce, or you also have to ship, or you also have to pay for. And I think the simplicity that you're describing makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, or I actually went to a Kickstarter panel. Jamie Tanner, who's a great cartoonist out in Brooklyn, he actually now works for Kickstarter. He was sort of one of the first cartoonists to utilize Kickstarter, and he ended up getting hired by them. And so he does some really nice Kickstarter panels at various shows, and I can't remember which convention it was at, but I sat in on one. And one of the pieces of advice that I heard from some like weathered Kickstarter people was to really pay attention to like things that take your time as the creator. So, you know, if you say like, I'm going to draw something in each person's book, they were like, don't charge $5 for that. Charge $20 for that. Because, you know, I think I had the same amount, like 200 people ordered the book and the other 200 people ordered the book plus a sketch. And so that took a month, you know, of just like sitting down and doing a nice sketch in each person's book and signing it to them and all that stuff. So, you know, definitely price that out as a premium because, yeah, a lot of people put in these crazy stretch goals where it's like, then I'll do a unique drawing for every backer. Then I'll do hand-drawn bookmarks for everyone.
Everyone
it's
gets
like,
a
oh
personalized song.
Yeah. And there is like a weird thing with Kickstarter where it can just kind of like go viral, you know, and you end up with 1,000 backers or something. And yeah, yikes. I just can't imagine. So I tried as much as possible to keep things simple. And that I think that worked pretty well. You know, most of my energy was spent just like filling orders, putting the books out there. But even just mailing out 500 of anything, you know, is a big
project. Well, so I love some of what you've written about the importance of recording like your day-to-day life, coupled somewhat with the self-awareness that that's the kind of storytelling that you've been the most comfortable doing for much of your career. Mm-hmm. And Basewood then obviously is entirely different. It's fantastical. The primary antagonist is a dragon. Can you talk, though, about the sort of simplistic world of the story? I don't mean that in a negative way at all, just that it's – it's a pretty heavy contrast to the detailed world building that's like really hot in fantasy right now. Mm-hmm. And in contrast, Basewood is almost allegorical.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just something like I grew up in the Pacific Northwest and I spent a lot of time as a kid just like running around in the woods. I was born in 1979. So like Return of the Jedi came out when I was like 4 years old. So I'm like a prime, you know, like Ewok candidate. I think like there's just a couple things in my life that sort of, you know, like definitely the whole concept of Endor. Or like that TV movie, The Battle for Endor.
I was just about to mention that.
Yeah.
Just in case you were familiar.
So that's something that like came out in 1985. My dad taped it using our VCR. And so like I used to watch that tape just like over and over and over again.
Me too.
And then I actually went back and rewatched it like recently. And so many things are similar to Basewood. Like I literally think that I sort of like internalized that story because there's like the monster up on the cliff in a cave. Yeah. And then sort of just the kind of Ewok ethos of like living in the trees and sort of being at peace with nature and stuff. And then there was another one that really affected me. And I really should look up the name of this movie, but it's like a Chinese film about a school teacher. And they're sort of way out in the countryside. And I don't even remember what the time era is. Or like Little House on the Prairie, all these sorts of little things. There's something about that resonates with me, sort of exactly like you're saying, not in a negative way, but just a more simple life.
Like homesteading.
You know, yeah, homesteading, right? Pre-electricity, you know, just where you don't have a million dishes. You have one pot, one pan, and one dish or something. Yeah. And so you have to take care of those. Or, it's funny because Basewood was published in France by a Belgian publisher called L'Employé du Mois. And they actually inserted an essay into the back of the book that's like, this book is so American because it's all about the Wild West and, you know, homesteading and going out in your covered wagon. And like that had never even occurred to me. But when they read it, they were just like, oh, of course, this is so American, which I thought was really funny. And like every review of my book in French, that's like what they home in on. It's like, oh, this American author is like really trying to express his Western heritage or whatever.
Also with the dragons, right?
Yeah, and then dragons. So, yeah, but I don't know. I think it just sort of comes from sort of my or Isle of Elsie is the same thing, right? It's like a very simple time and there's no electricity and everything's either a windmill or a watermill. And I don't know. Maybe it's just wish fulfillment. It's like, oh, geez, that sure sounds nice to me. I wish I could go back in time and I'm sure it was horrible and cold and whatever, but we can daydream, right?
Well, yeah. You know, speaking of Star Wars too, I mean, there's the Star Wars holiday special. It's that time of year now. There's a lot to draw from there too.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I've only seen that once, but holy moly, it's hard to unsee it after you've seen it.
It certainly is. I think it kind of changes your whole outlook on Star Wars and kind of in life, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's also just sort of like you were saying, like, you know, there's kind of these archetypical characters in Basewood, sort of the old man, which is kind of a stand-in for, I don't know, Obi-Wan Kenobi or a wizard or whatever, sort of helping this young man figure out his quest and stuff. But it also, I don't know. I mean, to me, Basewood still does stem from like my own life experiences. And it was me trying to deal with like getting over a relationship and stuff. So it has all these different layers. But then on the surface, it's also like an amnesia story, which is like the biggest cliche ever. There's actually a book written about like amnesia. So my dad is a doctor. He's a neurologist. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was starting working on Basewood, I was like, okay, Dad, so walk me through it. Like where in your brain do you get hit so that like you can't remember anything? And he was like, that doesn't exist. I was like, what do you mean? You know, everybody knows that amnesia, that, you know, like Kermit the Frog and the Muppets Take Manhattan, you know, he gets hit by the taxi cab and then he can't remember who he is or whatever the night before the show. And my dad was just like, yeah, it doesn't exist. It's totally like a made up thing. And so I started researching it online and he's right. There's like one documented case in the history of humanity where someone like genuinely like got bumped on the head and lost their memory. It's almost completely a literary device, which I had no idea.
That's incredible.
I can't remember. Yeah, I can't remember the name of the book, but some writer did like a sort of an extended essay where they just go through and they look at all these different literary characters. It's probably called Amnesia or something like that. but they look at throughout history, it's been this literary device that, you know, Charles Dickens and just everybody, Shakespeare, everyone has used this thing for hundreds of years of like, oh, I can't remember where I am, because it's sort of a perfect you know, like in Basewood, it really pulls you in.
Yeah, it's the perfect framing device for the beginning of a story where the character learns
what's going on. The reader doesn't know what's going on either. Mm-hmm. So it sort of syncs everything up. But yeah, it pretty much doesn't exist. So
I guess the actual real life equivalent is if that happened to you, you probably have lost motor control and you're drooling and have other.
Yes. It's sort of a convenient forgetting, right? Like, I can't remember my name, but I sure know how to walk and, you know.
And speak.
I still remember English. Yeah, all that
stuff. I know
stuff.
All of the words that you're saying to me. I just can't. Right. Yeah.
Right. Yep. So, I think the brain is not quite as nuanced as we think in that particular instance.
Yeah, it's too bad.
Man.
Yeah. It's
you're
fun.
You're ruining
it's
the magic,
fun.
Man.
Sorry, guys.
Next, you're going to tell us that dragons aren't real.
No, I would never say that.
Okay, good.
They're just extinct or hiding.
Dormant.
Yes, there's a prominent dragon in Isle of Elsie. There will be lots of dragons in that world.
Well, you've done some cover work, like for Bravest Warriors. That's that's out by Boom Studios. You've done illustration work for bands and magazines. So much of your work relies on the pacing and sequential nature of stories unfolding kind of one panel at a time. So what, if anything, translates between the two, illustration and covers? Do you approach illustration almost like single panel comics to tell a story, or is it a different process for you?
Wow, these are really good questions, you guys. Color me impressed.
Well, we pay a lot for them. There's a Chinese company that has...
They whip them up for you.
It's super important that everybody knows that the questions are all from me, not Aaron.
Okay, so Aaron is just reading your questions.
Exactly. Can you hear it in his voice when he stumbles over the script? It's 100% my doing. I am all the brains. He's all the brawn.
It is important to note that I own 51% of the podcast, though.
Yeah. So.
Well, to get back to your question.
Right.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I really see myself as a cartoonist when I'm like at a wedding and people say, oh, hey, Alec, what do you do? I look them in the eye and I say, I am a cartoonist. And I think that's really important. I really, if I could stop drawing illustrations tomorrow or covers, I would do it. I have no like horse in that game or whatever that saying is.
But Alec, when you say cartoonist, does that for you inherently, does that imply that there's a sequential nature to the cartoons? Like,
yes, absolutely.
It's not a single panel thing.
Yeah. I mean, I went to school and studied illustration at Pratt Institute. Mm-hmm. You know, I am fully trained as an illustrator and I do a lot of illustration. You know, it's like a weird inequity in the world right now, but like some of those publishers you rattled off that I've worked for to do comics, like, you know, sort of the standard paying gig for comic for the last 10 years still to this day is like, oh, you know, we'll give you like $100 a page, you know, not for the big two or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you're doing like an anthology piece and it's like, oh, do a 4-page comic and we'll give you $400. Or I can shit out a little tiny, you know, illustration or something or a cover drawing, which takes one thousandth of the effort, one thousandth of the skill, all that stuff, you know, and it'll pay twice as much just because of the way the market values it. So, I almost like can't, it's such a great question, but I almost can't honor it with like a response. Cause like, I just don't put that much effort or thinking or anything into my illustration. Cause it's, this is going to sound really arrogant, but it's just easy for me where it's like making a single image. You only have to think about compositional elements within that image. You know, like to me, cartoonists make the best illustrators cause, like that James Patterson project where they said, oh, 200 illustrations in 4 months. And I was just like, okay, I can do that. You know, because you think about it and you start going, well, okay, a page of comics is 2x3. So that's 6 drawings per page. So if I take 400 and divide it by 6 or whatever, it's like, I can't actually do that math in my head. But, you know, it's like a 100-page comic or something. You know, it becomes very manageable very fast. So I know I probably sound like a jerk, but this is what I tell my comic students at CCS and CCA. I say, if you guys want to make some money, like, nobody's going to pay you to draw comics, but if you want to make some money, be an illustrator, because comics, cartoonists are like the best illustrators in the world, because, you know, we have to draw people over and over and over again 1,000 times within a book or something. So to draw something once is like not a big deal. And I'm not saying that I'm the world's best illustrator, that I'm so great at drawing or any of those things, but, you know, like, when someone says draw a cover, do an illustration, I could do that in a night or something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's much harder to think about the compositional elements and the flow over multiple panels, over pages, over two-page spreads, all that kind of stuff. It takes a much more robust skill set to work in comics than to just do an illustration.
No, that makes total sense to me. I think that one leads to the other, but in the way that you described it, like, it's illustration may be sort of celebrated from a financial standpoint,
uh-huh,
right?
Yeah.
It's rewarded in a much greater capacity, but the skill set is kind of, you really have to level up to go from illustration work to something more sequential, because
Right. Because
you're talking about multiple illustrations on the page. I mean, it's just,
it's a different skill, you know, like some
yeah.
of my students come in and they've been doing illustration for years and they're like, oh, but you know, this comic stuff is hot right now, so I want to learn this skill set. And they make the mistake of, they'll try to do a page of comics. Let's say it's a 2x3 grid. They'll do 6 panels that are like perfectly fully rendered in their illustration style.
Makes
it almost impossible to read.
Because
cartooning is, you know, sort of the simplification of life, and it's more like graphic design or something. You need to just be able to glance at it, pick up the information, and move to the next panel so that you can flow through the story and get enveloped in it and sort of get pulled in. So it's you know, a little bit more watered down or whatever, but it takes a lot more skill to balance everything out and create a seamless reading experience for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, the composition, the approach to the composition is entirely different. So I think that what you're describing about, like, your kind of mental approach to a single night's drawing, a single task from an illustration standpoint versus pages telling a story, makes total sense to me.
Yeah, and I mean, and then it goes one more step in the other direction, which is, so my French publisher, L'Emploi du Mois, they have a big exhibit at this year's Angoulême Festival in France, the big international comics festival.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to have a monitor up, and they have maybe 15 or 20 authors under their publishing house. And so they want to have, and their logo is like a little guy walking, pushing a cart. So they want to have all of their authors do just like a walk cycle animation.
Is this the Angus animation that you posted?
Yeah, of Argus. Yeah, walking.
Argus,
snow.
Right.
And so that's a character from Basewood. So that's the character I chose, and I did this, and it was like 15 frames. It is not, you know, it's about as simple, left foot forward, right foot forward, and then it loops. But I did that with one of my characters, and oh my God, like, hand-drawn animation, you know, illustration is to comics as comics is to hand-drawn illustration or animation, because you draw and I spent a couple weeks on this. I was in between issues of Phase 7, so it was a nice little break. But I mean, I spent weeks on this and just countless hours drawing this thing out. And then in the end, you get, you know, a second of animation that then loops or something. So I mean, you know, you look at some of these hand-drawn animated movies from back in the day, and it's like, oh my God, just hundreds and hundreds of people drawing just to get an hour and a half. Whereas,
wow,
you know, Basewood is 7 years of drawing to get an hour and a half, but at least you read it all in one book.
Mm-hmm.
So I animators are even crazier than us, but I sort of look down on illustration, and I think it's a much simpler task than comics.
I kind of have a question in terms of the teaching and like thinking about doing like cover work versus, you know, actual comics work. Besides, you know, the monetary, so say, you know, you get paid twice as much for a cover as you might for doing the interiors. There's an exposure element to that, though, isn't there? Like, people get familiar with work because of cover sometimes. Like, I know people get discovered, or it's like, oh yeah, I know that name because he did the variant cover for, so, you know, whatever, Guardians of the Galaxy 23 or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm sort of I probably sound like a jerk to a lot of people listening right now.
Maybe we're jerks too.
But I think like there's nothing wrong with it. It's just more like from where I am, because, like, yeah, you know, like my friend Joe Quinones, who's probably like the person that I know that does the most mainstream stuff. I mean, like, I look at his covers and I'm just like, wow, I am in awe. Mm. And I think he does more covers than interior work, but like, you know, he is someone that I think built his name on just making jaw-droppingly beautiful cover art, and then that has sort of led to expanding his career. When people see his comics, they know who he is because of that. But I guess just for me, it's like, you know, I did a couple covers for Boom for Bravest Warriors, and they said, these are great, you know, and we like how you draw. Do you want to pitch us some Adventure Time comics or some Bravest Warriors comics? And I just said, no, sorry, like, I'm not gonna, I just know the amount of time that's you know, invested in like creating even just one page of comics. And I'm not going to spend my time like giving away that skill set or whatever, because the reward is never going to be equal to the task. And mm-hmm. I'd rather mm-hmm. just spend that time working and creating my own work. Mm-hmm. So
wow.
It was just like a weird line in the sand where they were like, oh, you should do some comics for us. And I was like, no, I have zero interest in doing that. I'll draw some more covers for you. I don't, you know, I could sit down in an afternoon and knock out a cover and be like, all right, whatever, get some money in the bank account. But, for comics, at least, I just want to draw my own stuff.
Okay, but honestly, though, Marvel comes to you and says, can you do a backup story for one of the Star Wars comics?
I would never work for Marvel.
Really?
That doesn't take any thought. No, I would never work
Even for if it's Star Wars, though?
No, shame on them. They've done so many horrible things.
Ah, okay.
They would never get any of my work, so.
Okay. Well, back to the rigors of self-publishing, except we're going to, like, acknowledge it and then let it go for a second. Okay. Because the demands on time and focus are, you know, infinite. You have to do it for the love, but mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it cannot be all that you do. It just can't. Like, it has to be important for you to do something else besides comics, besides drawing. So how do you decompress and shut that part of your brain off for a little while?
Pinball.
Really?
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Seriously?
I own a pinball machine. I live about 5 blocks from the Pacific Pinball Museum. So when I need to blow off some steam, I will turn on my pinball machine and play a couple games. Yeah.
That explains the Weezer t-shirt.
Yes. I did a, I pitched, Weezer said, do a t-shirt for us. And I thought they'll never go for this in a million years. But I pitched them sort of like a pinball play field that incorporates all the different songs of their new album, Everything Will Be All Right in the End. And they were like, that looks cool. And I was like, no way. So yeah, I also do a pinball zine with my buddy, John Chad.
Awesome. So I had a request from a listener to ask you what your favorite track from the new Weezer album is.
I really like I've Had It Up to Here. Okay. It's actually sort of ties into what we're talking about. Weezer's have been on like an interesting path of dealing with big business, right? Being with Universal Music or whatever, and then trying to get back to their roots and keep their fans happy and stuff. But so that song has a very like, you know, I don't need to work for the man, I can do this myself kind of vibe, which I really like. So
awesome. Do you and your wife, how is she, by the way?
Like, she is great. Yes, she has totally bounced back from her surgery. And luckily, thyroid cancer is one of the most treatable forms of cancer. So all her doctors kept saying, like, oh, man, if you're going to get cancer, this is the one to get.
Gosh, why would you say that?
A little mind bending. But yeah, she's doing quite well. So
excellent.
Everything's back to normal.
What do you guys do around the Bay Area?
We work from home, and I would say we spend 90% of our time in our studio and at home. as you were saying, you sort of don't make a lot of money doing this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I would say we work a lot.
Okay. You work a lot.
When do we get out, we like to, we'll like go into the city and, you know, go to some of the parks. We're going to go for Christmas. We're going to go up to, there's this place called Rancho Obi-Wan. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. Steve Sansweet, who's like the world's craziest Star Wars collector, took his whole Star Wars collection and like bought an abandoned chicken ranch or something. And he's filled like 5 warehouses with all his crap. So we're going to go up there. It's up in Petaluma. and we're going to go up to the Redwoods and see like the Redwoods. So, awesome. But yeah, we do all this stuff. You know, we'll go on a hike when like friends come in from out of town. We'll go out to Golden Gate Bridge and House of Fine Arts. And I'll wander around San Francisco sometimes and play pinball.
Right on.
All that kind of stuff.
you get out of the studio occasionally, which is really what I'm hoping.
Usually like go up until some sort of breaking point, and then it's like, I gotta get out of here. And I teach online now too. I mean, that's the other way I make my living, is teaching for CCS through the internet into Vermont. And then,
oh man, you're just killing it with my transitions, because that's my next question.
Cool. Yeah, so anyways, all that stuff now happens indoors in my apartment. So I spent a lot of time in here. No joke. Okay.
Well, so I have like 50 Infinity soapboxes, and one of them is education. Cool. So every time we talk to a creator who's also an educator, like, I would spend the entire time swapping stories of pedagogy and philosophy, but Aaron would kill me for that. So instead, let me ask this. What have you changed about your teaching since you started, either in terms of content, like something that you felt like you realized it was missing from the curriculum that, like, whoa, why don't you guys know this? This is important. Or in terms of approach, like being more sympathetic or more critical or more subjective, et cetera. Like, what have you changed since you started teaching?
Yeah, that's a great question. I started in 2008, so I guess I've been at it for 5 years now, at least at CCS. I was doing some teaching before then. I think the class that I teach at CCS is professional practices, which is kind of everything we're talking about, you know, trying to figure out a way to make a living and make your cartooning practice sustainable so that you can continue to make comics, because it doesn't usually bring in a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I think for that class, at least, it's just like, what isn't changing? I mean, you know, like when I started teaching that class, it was like, well, does everyone have a MySpace page? You know, and now it's like, zap, that's gone. And now it's Facebook, or, you know, Tumblr has popped up in the interim there. So, I mean, I feel like I'm constantly having to shift the curriculum just constantly to try and keep up with all the different tools that are popping up, you know, suddenly. It's like, oh, well, you can put PDFs up on Gumroad. And I mean, I learn as much from my students as they learn from me in regards to some of the technology that's out there. Because, I mean, even just like Twitter, like when that class started, Twitter wasn't that big of a thing. And I had this great student, Josh Kramer, who does the cartoon Picayune, sort of nonfiction comics. And he was like, oh, man, you guys should really check out Twitter. And he just sort of had a bee in his bonnet about it. And then that's become like a crucial part of the curriculum, like talking about how you can use Twitter to, you know, get your work out there or help you with a crowdfunding campaign, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of like what I've changed in my teaching style, I feel like I'm at a turning point right now. This was a really hard semester for me. But I feel like when I left Pratt, I kind of looked back at it and I thought, you know, the teachers that I learned the most from are the ones that kind of kicked my ass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the teachers that are just like, oh, yeah, that looks good, whatever. You know, I'm not sure I learned that much from them. But the ones who made me work hard and demanded a lot of me, you know, like, I feel like I learned a lot, or it pushed me to a new place where I was able to break through and learn new things. So I've made a conscious effort. Like, I'm actually a pretty nice guy, but I think a lot of my students are freaked out by me and they're like, whoa, Alec is such a jerk or so intense or whatever. And I've sort of cultivated that, like, especially on the first class, I'm a pretty big asshole where I'm just like, all right, listen up, you know, you're going to work hard in this class, and sort of a big dose of tough love. Especially like in an arts community where everyone's like, oh, it's okay. And, you know, California where everyone's like, oh, no problem, man.
Everybody gets 11 out of 10 on the assignment.
Yeah,
everybody.
You're 15 minutes late. No worries, brah, or whatever. And I just freak out at people. Like, how dare you walk into my class late? You know, and it's like, you're going to learn stuff here. And you think I can't teach you in 15 minutes? I'll change your life in 15 minutes. You better fucking be here when the class starts or whatever.
Awesome.
But I feel like I've maybe pushed that a little too far. I've been getting some blowback recently, especially through teaching online, where it's like some of that is translating to just, this guy's a jerk, and not quite coming through as like, oh, tough love, I get it. He's trying to make me work hard so that, you know, I don't know. It's hard for students, I think, because it is such an intense – both of these are really intense MFA programs. But it's like, it's the bad news is, I'll never forget, I was like 3 months away from finishing my degree at Pratt, and the head dean guy walked in and he said, boy, you guys really look stressed out, because everyone's like frantically trying to get their final projects together. And he just said, you know, it doesn't get easier. Like, when you guys leave, it's not going to get easier. It's actually going to get harder, right? Because right now you're like, oh no, I might get an F or something. Whereas later it's like, oh no, I got to make rent. So I think the students that can put up with that or survive, or, you know, I worked through some really difficult classes at Pratt and stuff, but that made me stronger, and it prepared me for even more difficult challenges of being out in the real world and trying to scrape together a freelance living, which I've been doing since 2007. So, yeah, I don't know. Does that answer your question? That's
yeah, it does. No, it's great. It's actually it's sort of refreshing to hear somebody acknowledge that maybe you need to lighten up a little bit as a teacher. You know, like you're reconciling what you took from your own education experience and like the things that had the greatest impact on you and just trying to fit that into like your approach as a teacher. And it's good to hear kind of what you have realized might need to be adjusted slightly. And especially with the awareness that the tone teaching online is different than, you know, face to face.
Oh like my gosh. Yeah. So
yeah. Different. Like what kind of support system do your students have like, or expect from you as their instructor, like when they don't have that face to face time? It's interesting to hear.
Yeah. It's just a totally different dynamic. You know, if you're in person and class is wrapping up and everyone's packing up their bags, you know, three or four people come over and be like, oh, hey man, what about this or whatever? And other people right. might not be asking that, but they're listening to it. And it's like, oh, I heard you talking to whoever about whatever. Whereas this, you know, everyone just kind of shuffles out of the room and then you might get an email from someone, but more likely you won't. And then 4 months later, you'll find out, well, I didn't like that thing you said 4 months ago. And it's like, what?
Hmm. Yeah, the kind of casual banter, like the, right, exactly. The casual interaction part is sort of eliminated, which is so funny to hear or to realize, because so much of what people tout as like online interaction is the fact that it can be really casual and almost sort of anonymous. But when you turn that around in an educational environment, like you're sort of missing that part, because it becomes only that formal instruction and interaction in that way. And
yeah,
the banter is... it's so
especially
important.
Especially at CCS, sorry to jump in, but especially at CCS, which is in, you know, White River Junction, which is a town of 2,000 people. So, right. I mean, that's not a place where it's just casual interaction after class. I mean, you walk out the door, you run into the person again, and then you go to your apartment building, and one of your students is your next door neighbor. And then, you know, you go to dinner that night, and someone else is at the supermarket or whatever. I mean, you just run into people constantly. So there's sort of this great community there. So that's been a hard transition for me, is trying to figure out how to achieve some of that from the West Coast. But yeah, we're going to keep talking about it. I might try and fly out there a couple times next year to get a little bit more FaceTime with them or something like that.
Makes sense.
Well, this is the part of the show that's the hardest for people to deal with. So I hope you're ready.
I'm ready.
It's where we ask you what you're reading, watching, listening to these days that our audience should check out. Maybe this being the end of the year and all, a few things you can think of from this year that are kind of musts for people to be aware of.
Okay. Well, one that I just finished reading, this will tie up many loose ends here. There was another Kickstarter for all ages fantasy called Cartosia Tales.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And I agreed to draw a cover for one of them.
Oh,
so,
did you?
I've been going through, so I just read like in a flurry. I just read the first, I think, 7 issues to prepare to draw something for them. And that's just fun. I mean, if you have kids, or if you're a fan of kind of all ages fantasy stuff, this is just such a cool idea. They basically drew the map first for the world, and then they split it into different sections. So it's got all these cities and landmarks dotted all over it. And then they sort of improvise each issue, and the characters explore a different part of the map. And so there's about 9 creators with a couple guest people each issue. They go around and explore it. But that's a really fun series that I just finished reading or catching up with. I think it's going to go to 10 issues.
Yes.
And that will have one of my cover drawings on it, which I will do in an afternoon, which will be fun. What else have I been reading? I just started reading The Expeditioners by Sarah Stewart Taylor, who is a fellow teacher at CCS, which I'm really enjoying. It's sort of a steampunk. It's just a novel. It's illustrated by Catherine Roy, who's a CCS alumni. I'm finally reading that. An Enjoyance by McSweeney's published that. McSweeney's McMullins. geez, I don't know. I'm pretty excited about the new Hobbit movie. I really like dragons. So, like, when that second one ended, it was like, the dragons flying off to destroy the... I was, like, rubbing my hands, and then it was like, roll credits. No! Oh. So, I'm excited to go see that in the theater to finally just watch him burn everything down. That'll be fun.
Awesome.
Yeah, is that good enough? Sure. And then Weezer's new album. I'm going to buy that for a bunch of people for Christmas this year. Everything will be all right in the end. It's the best Weezer album if you're a jilted Weezer lover where you're like, "Oh, they haven't done anything that I've liked since Pinkerton or whatever. Come on back. They're ready to welcome you back. It's a really great album."
That's wonderful.
It's so delightful hearing you have like that passion about something that has been part of your life since you were what, like 12, 14
or something. Yeah.
Right. And then like, it's super kick-ass that then you did their t-shirt, you've done a poster for them. Like, that's so fucking rad.
Yeah. I got to like go backstage and pour my heart out in Rivers Cuomo's face. Just aww. Like, I love you, man. You don't know how much your music awesome. Is meant to me over the years, you know? So yeah.
I hope all you my did dreams it just are like coming that.
True. My life is good. Everything's good over here.
Oh, excellent. Well, thanks again to Alec Longstreth for joining us on the couch this week. Thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We will see you next week.
Thanks, guys.